From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thanks for being with us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We open this week's recap with a conversation no one wanted to have. The mass shooting in Florida has provoked a discussion on school safety. Is it time for more layers of security in schools? Is there another way to address the issue?
We welcomed school leaders who offered their own views on guns in school and how to keep students safe.
I was actually a police officer for 27 years, so and firearms training was one of the things I did for a number of years there. I believe that you can train someone how to fire a weapon. It's a skill that needs to be practiced regularly. It's not something you can train a person once and then just say, okay, well, when you need this, go ahead and do it. I believe that definitely in the heat of the moment that not everybody's going to be able to rise to the occasion and actually use a firearm. And I don't expect that everybody should, or I don't believe that that's something we should be doing is arming the teachers. I don't necessarily think that's a great idea, my opinion.
Okay. And Kimberly, you said no to that. No to arming teachers.
No, but I want to clarify that we do have a partnership with Gates Police. So we do have SROs in all of our buildings, including our elementary schools that are, again, establishing great relationships with our kids. I think for me, our training that we just engage in with our administrators and certainly preparing for in the spring is guns aren't the only forms of weapons. And that's really part of our training in terms of what else can we do or what else can we use in order to slow an intruder down. And that comes from all kinds of ideas and thoughts around that. And I think that's why we're especially interested in getting this out to our teachers so that they feel empowered and engaged and certainly competent and in protecting, because there isn't an educator out there. And it goes back to Florida. And we know there's been, you know, a lot of certainly honoring the teacher that lost his life once he was in the hospital, I believe. And teachers will do whatever they can to protect their kids. And it's what we signed up for. It's what we are as educators. And I couldn't be more proud to be part of the profession.
In about 20 seconds, Trina, can you envision a future where teachers are armed or at least have firearms available to them in classrooms as a safety measure?
I hope not. As a superintendent, as a former teacher, I don't believe there's a place in schools for teachers to carry firearms.
Next, a conversation about racism and what we tell our kids about race. Several local organizations are leading a weekend rally in Rochester against the kinds of racism they say is coming from the Trump administration.
We sat down with Howard Eagle, a local organizer, Minister Clifford Florence, and Larry Knox, a labor leader. In this clip, they're having a discussion with a caller named Tim, a white Trump supporter who says that he taught his own children to be colorblind.
Let's be kind and let's do some work.
Stopping racism right at the gate. I taught my kids to be colorblind.
No. See, that's where you're really mistaken. You can't stop racism at the gate by being kind.
Well, he says taught his kids to be colorblind.
Well, that's bad. That's trouble.
Hold on. I think everybody has equal goals here. But Howard, you said it's bad that Tim taught his kids to be colorblind.
Absolutely. It is backwards, Tim. If you teach your children, excuse me, Tim, you won't let me speak.
I taught my children that everyone I know regardless.
Tim, let Howard respond.
Go ahead,
Howard.
What my comment is about being colorblind. I know many white people say that, and they believe they're making a progressive statement. They're trying to be kind, as you said, and so forth. But I have dark skin, and my children have dark skin, and my grandchildren and my cousins, aunts, uncles have dark skin. If you're telling me that you don't see our skin color, then you don't see part of us. And that's a problem right from the beginning. We're not invisible people. We're not opaque. We are brown. We are black. We are, you understand? We want you to see that because that is a part of us. That is a part of our humanity. So to teach your children that, in my view, as an educator, is a mistake on your part. And I would advise you to try to undo that. But I would be willing to talk with you more about why I say these kinds of things, right? So that's part of what keeps the confusion going, is that often when we think we're doing what's, you know, correct, politically correct, I guess you would say, we're causing more damage. And we don't talk about it. We don't get an opportunity to really talk about it, to discuss it at a deep level so that we can come to an understanding. Because you may be thinking, well, who is this black guy? He must be crazy telling me that I'm wrong to teach my children to be colorblind. But I'm not saying that off the top of my head.
Okay, go ahead, Tim.
I respect you, and I think you have a valid opinion. However, I think if you met either one of my children and it didn't know who they were, you would think they were wonderful, kind, loving people because they don't look at your skin color first. They get to know you.
If your children tell me that they don't see my skin color, that's a problem. So
well,
that's
I'm
all
sure
I'm saying.
So, I'm sure they'll understand what color you are, but I think they'll get to know you before
well,
they come
they can't
up with any
understand what color
them.
I am without looking at my skin color. But that's beside the point. Really, what is the work that is to be done if we are serious about impacting racism in all of its forms, individually, institutionally, and structurally? That's the critical question. That's why we're gathering on Saturday, to take a stand against racism, but hopefully to move toward working together to impact it. It's not going to just go away magically. It's not because we stopped talking about it or because we're being nice. That's not going to end it.
Not at all.
Now, Tim, I would say, too, just, I mean, with I appreciate you calling in and talking with us, and these are conversations that need to be had, because I think the president has done a lot of damage. He's not going to change who he is, and he's just going to continue on the track that he is, because, you know, he's a 7-year-old, 5-year-old man, or however old he is, he's not going to change. But I think, you know, for us to continue these kind of conversations, for you that as somebody that was or, you know, had voted for Trump, and for others, you know, and your friends and neighbors and family that also, and kind of realize at the very least, no matter where we agree or disagree, that, okay, things are off track, and it's because of this presidency.
Next, the Trump administration wants to change food stamps. Specifically, they want to cut funding and to limit food choices by sending food boxes directly to families.
That brought some strong reactions from our listeners, including Elizabeth, the caller whom you'll hear first in this clip. Then you'll hear a team from FoodLink, Mitch Gruber, Mark Dwyer, and Flo Clements.
Boy, did you guys hit a nerve. Take away choices. I don't know how old you guys are, but as a child, I remember getting the stuff, flour, powdered milk, the cheese, you know, and you stand in line and it's kind of demeaning, you know. Mama's got you by the hand and then, anyways, that's not really the thing. The thing also was, you know, you're trying to tell me what I can buy and what I can't buy. And also, the programs here in Rochester, above all, work really well. I've known people that get more than $100, and then they'll drop down, and then possibly even $17, you know, and after a few months, because they're constantly getting recertified. You can't just go without getting recertified every three months, especially if you have a job in a house provider. You know, it's not just people that don't have jobs that are getting these things. It's people that actually have jobs that don't have enough money. And I don't know. I just don't think. And the other thing is, you stand in line and people are staring at you. What did you buy? That's they need to stop talking about that altogether. I don't buy a lot of soda, but once in a while when I do, I just don't want them looking at me like, you know, I've done something wrong. I think it's not right.
Elizabeth, thank you for the phone call. I appreciate that. You can hear how upset she is just about this proposal, and that's an aspect that I think we haven't fully explored here, Mitch, which is not just the logistics, could you do this, not just whether this is a Trojan horse to cut overall spending, but keep in mind that studies have shown that people on SNAP roughly spend their food dollars the same way that people who are not on SNAP don't, which means, by the way, we all could make healthier choices. Me too, probably just about everybody listening. But people on SNAP are not in some wildly different category of how they eat. And this is a caller who feels insulted. You know, there's a dignity issue, I think.
Yeah, she completely struck a nerve with me, too. So I appreciate the call. Just a couple of thoughts about the way this could be administered. And again, here's my second point, my second time saying it. This is a distraction. Let's not get distracted by it. Let's not allow budgets to be cut on SNAP moving forward. But there's a couple issues that I think are really important. The first one is dignity, as she mentioned. Mm-hmm. She struck a nerve again because this is a wartime measure, giving people food rations. And taking people's dignity away is really, it's just shameful. And we've done so much good work in this state and across the country with things like food stamps. For example, EBT, the electronic benefits transfer. So it used to be food stamps were actually stamps, and there was a ton of stigma associated with using them in a store. We have gotten to a point where now you cannot tell the difference unless you're staring. You can't tell the difference between an EBT card and a credit card. And folks are at the store and they're buying food, and it really destigmatizes the program. And frankly, the state right now is working on the same measure with WIC to incorporate WIC benefits on the same EBT card. We have done good work. It has made callers like Elizabeth feel better about going to the store and utilizing a nutrition assistance program. We should not be taking steps backwards from that.
Fraud rates went down because of the EBT card, actually.
Right.
There's an electronic trail of each purchase. So that's one of the reasons why fraud's dropped recently.
And then just one other point that I think really needs to be mentioned, taking choice away, aside from the dignity issue, which is a huge one, it's frankly unsafe. We are right now in a time where food allergies are rampant, and we know that people die from things like nut allergies and other allergens out there. And to send someone home with peanut butter when their child is allergic to it is dangerous. And I'd love for Tom Reed to address that point specifically.
And I want to say one thing, too, is a quote. There was one of the sites that Curbside goes to. We had a young lady who comes on Curbside, and she said, you know, I love when you guys come. You, even though we're poor, you treat us with dignity. You treat us with respect. You don't look down on us. You serve us. And that's what it's all about. You know, we want to make sure that when we pull off, we met our goal. You know, we made someone feel good about what they're, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, we don't treat you as a person that just because you're receiving SNAP benefits and you're using them. We treat you with respect.
We'll end this week with a question. What's going on with photonics in Rochester? Back in 2015, Vice President Joe Biden came to Rochester to lead a celebration. Rochester would become a photonics hub with thousands of jobs and billions of dollars in investment.
But almost 3 years later, photonics has yet to replace other industries as a local jobs leader. We welcomed Vinny Esposito, Regional Director for New York State Empire Development. He says it's important to be patient and allow some of the investments to grow and pay off. But that didn't sit well with Mark Cassini, Gatestown supervisor. He called the show to challenge Esposito.
The initial promise that was made was thousands of jobs. In fact, Congresswoman Louise Slaughter had promised on a number of media outlets that we would be getting between 5,000 and 7,000, and she said likely 6,000 jobs with the adding of the Photonics Center. So I asked the question, and I'm going to pose it to you. What analysis did you have that shows 6,000? Why not 8,000? Why not 12,000? Why not 4,000? Could you show me the analysis? So I asked the congresswoman. She sent through her office a response which said, well, we're basing it on a projection out 10 years from now, what the worldwide market would be, and we're hoping to attract a certain percentage of that worldwide market. And I said, do you have any details? And the answer is, well, those details came from Sonny Polly. They have the plan. They have the analysis and the details. I foiled Sonny Polly. Sonny Polly has responded and said, no, we really don't have those details. We have nothing that supports that claim of 6,000 jobs. There are no supporting documents for that. So I ask you, what is the estimate of jobs you think this area is going to get with this? Is there an estimate? Or is it, we hope someday this might grow into something good? And keep in mind that there are photonic centers both in New York State and all over the country, including Boston, which is a very large photonic.
All right, Mark, let's let Vinny jump in with that first one there. So,
sure.
6,000, you know where that number came from?
I don't. I saw the exchanges between the Congresswoman's office and the town supervisor about this issue. I think it's realistic to think when we already have an industry that is 20,000 people strong that commercializing a technology as important to the future as integrated photonics could lead to an increase in 6,000 jobs. I don't think it's actually unrealistic to think that that happens or will happen
over
10
years. But was
that
arbitrary? That number, do you think that was arbitrary?
I can't say specifically where the estimate came from. I would have to go back and look to see if in the initial application from was led by SUNY Poly, but also partnered with University of Rochester and RIT to the Department of Defense, how they came up with that.
Well, let me help you if I could, not to cut your answer off, but I have in writing from the congresswoman that the numbers came from SUNY Poly. SUNY Poly has denied those numbers exist.
Okay, so
in writing.
Okay, there's going to be a disagreement then. Vinny Esposito, is there a number that you think is realistic as a projection?
I think that number is the number we should sort of strive to work towards. That's what we're investing so many dollars towards. And I would be happy to go back and look at the application to see if there's more detail. I have no reason to doubt that that was the response from SUNY Poly related to the supervisor, but there's other participating institutions and industry leaders that helped craft that application.
Is this a fair and relevant question, Vinny?
Of course it is.
Okay.
Yeah, we're investing a lot of taxpayer dollars from New York State into this particular institute. $250 million is nothing to sneeze at. We want a return on our investment, and everyone should be held accountable to get one. But it's important to note that it's not an overnight play. It's not a direct job creator. This has never said there are going to be 6,000 jobs at AIM Photonics. AIM Photonics is a facilitator. It is an institute to bring industry together to commercialize integrated photonics. But absolutely, we should make sure we're staying accountable to how many companies are coming here, how many jobs they're creating, how many people are using that facility when it comes online.
Mark, do you think that in any way that you're jumping the gun with criticism, that what Vinny is describing is not a day in July of 2015 where they said, great, we've brought one company here, and in 2 years, they're going to have 10,000 people working there? They were sort of sprinkling the ground for growth in a lot of different ways.
Right. Well, I'll be specific. When you put out a number and you say we need, in this case, between the state and the federal government, $360 million of taxpayers' money, and you say here are the number of jobs that are going to be produced, and you have nothing to back that up, that's an issue. If it were my business and you were doing that, the day would not end well. It would not be acceptable. It's taxpayers' money. We have to be more specific than that.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. Have a great weekend, everybody. He's Evan. I'm Megan. We'll talk to you Monday.